Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
In the book of Acts, chapter 17, we hear about Paul going amongst a group of Athenian philosophers and citizens to bring them the word of God in an unapologetic manner. These Athenian philosophers, Stoics and Epicureans, were unfamiliar with the words that Paul preached, and albeit curious, they were skeptical. Many, in fact, were devoted to the worship of the material world. In short, it was a difficult crowd to win over. But Paul persisted and won many a heart for Jesus. The site from which Paul delivered his famous sermon is commonly referred to as Mars Hill. How fitting, then, it is for a church some 2,000 years later to take the name of Mars Hill, particularly when it was founded in one of the least church regions of the United States and within the heart of one of the least church cities in that region. Started as a small Bible study group in Seattle, Washington, Mars Hill Church has become one of the fastest growing churches in the United States, with 8 branch locations spread throughout the Puget Sound and in New Mexico, and reaching several thousand worshipers each Sunday. In 2009, podcasts of Mars Hill sermons witnessed over 4 million downloads, demonstrating an even more impressive outreach. Beyond the branch locations directly affiliated with Mars Hill, lead pastor Mark Driscoll has been responsible for helping plant over 300 more churches throughout the United States through the Acts 29 network, and Pastor Driscoll has been active in spreading the Mars Hill's message via YouTube, Twitter, and Facebook, as well as more traditional media outlets such as USA Today and the Washington Post. If we continued listing the multiple accomplishments achieved and initiatives undertaken by Mark Driscoll and his pastoral staff at Mars Hill, we simply would run out of time. For our present purposes, we'd like to understand how a Bible study group of a couple dozen individuals was transformed into a leading powerhouse church in today's cultural environment. Pastor Driscoll, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thank you, buddy.
If we want to understand the growth of your church, I think the best place to start would be with your religious upbringing and what motivated you to take on this Herculean task of planting a church in downtown Seattle, pretty much a barren wasteland for religiosity. So what was your background growing up with Christianity? And were you raised a Christian?
I was raised in a Catholic family. I was not very devout, especially as I started toward my teen years, basically stopped going to church. Didn't have a bad experience, just was kind of indifferent and bored. And didn't go to church really for some years until college. And there I was at Washington State University studying communication and speech. And a gal in high school had given me a Bible, a pastor's daughter, and I was dating her at the time. Should not have been dating her at the time, because I wasn't a Christian yet. But started reading the Bible, became a Christian reading the Bible, and then ended up going to an evangelical church at that point. But up until that point, I wasn't going to church. I wasn't in a Bible study. I wasn't preparing for any life of ministry, that's for sure. And then God spoke to me in college, said to Mary Grace, this gal, plant churches, preach the Bible, and train men. And so it was kind of an audible voice of God day, and he told me to do 4 things. So that was in around 1990, or about 1990, I guess it would be. Mm-hmm. So that's what I've been doing ever since, is those 4 things.
And so you moved then to Seattle shortly thereafter, and in the mid-1990s, I believe your biography says that you started a small Bible study group that was essentially a group that was affiliated with the Antioch Bible Church. Is that correct?
Yeah, Antioch Bible Church on the east side, and Pastor Ken Hutchison, he had a good-sized church, African-American pastor, a lot of white pastors on staff, multi-ethnic congregation. So we were attending there, and I volunteered to help out in college ministry. Before long, was running that, and we were living in Seattle. Church was on the east side, And yeah, we started a small Bible study, intentionally hoping to become a church plant out of our home. And so it started in, let's say, 1996. We started the Bible study. It launched as a service on Sunday night in October of 1996. We had maybe 100 people the first night. A lot of those were friends and family and people who were encouraging us. The next week, it was maybe 60 people. And so that's pretty much where we started, maybe 60, 70, 80 people. Mm-hmm. Not a huge deal. It started pretty simple. A lot of college students, a lot of singles, a lot of young urban professionals.
So how, you mentioned that friends and families were the first people that reached out in this. Where were you meeting at the time with these 100 folks?
Yeah, we rented a church at night. We couldn't find anywhere we could afford during the morning. Most of our people were college students and indie rockers, musicians. So I didn't get a salary from the church for the first 3 years. Outside support and part-time jobs paid the bills. We were pretty broke. So we met at night, rented a small church, and had a small group of people that was growing, you know, fairly slowly, but it was growing.
Mm-hmm. And again, this is in downtown Seattle, to mention this to our listeners here who are listening from around the world. Seattle, as we mentioned in an earlier podcast with Jim Wellman, tends to be one of the least church countries in the region. So reaching out to this demographic must have been, in many ways, very challenging, the area around here. You said you had indie rockers and young men and such. So what was the challenge of trying to bring these individuals to church, and I would assume many for the first time?
Yeah, lots for the first time, and my real focus has always been on particularly reaching young men. Mm-hmm. The least likely person to go to church is a single man in his 20s. Sometimes when you're a kid, your mom will take you, and then you kind of hit your teen years, college, post-college. Most young guys don't go anywhere near a church. Maybe they get married, have a few kids, the marriage hits the skids, the kids need some values, and then maybe they'll go to church, but that kind of 18 to 35 range is pretty absent in most churches, especially if the guys are single. So that was really my heart, and I felt that's who I was supposed to go after. So to this day, we've got all ages and races, and I think there was 10,000 people on Sunday. Mm-hmm. There was 13,000 people for Easter last year. It was kind of our high water mark. But the largest demographic we have that I'm aware of is still single men in their 20s.
Wow.
And we get thousands of them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but then they end up becoming Christians, getting married, starting families. So hundreds of weddings a year, a lot of life transition.
We want to come back to that issue of the how you minister to young men in their 20s and early 30s. But I want to go back again to that early church planting era, because that is absolutely fascinating to me, just to understand the process of how this goes on and some of the difficulties you may have faced. In terms of the assistance that you got from people around you in the initial Bible study group and such, what was the general attitude that we're going to go out and plant a church and we hope it works? Did you have a game plan or something along that line?
Yeah, I mean, the hope was that it would survive and thrive, but we had seen a lot of church plants die and fail in the city.
Mm-hmm.
We'd seen churches with a lot more money or a lot bigger core group or with denominational backing, which I did not have. I also had not been to Bible college or seminary, so I wasn't formally trained. I mean, on paper, it didn't make any sense. We have no building. We have no money. I have no training. I've never been a pastor before. And we've got a lot of young people who are newer Christians. The variables just stacked up for complete failure.
Right.
This would not have been a church. If we were betting in Vegas, I wouldn't have put a dollar down on this deal. It just mm-hmm. didn't look hopeful. But we had a handful of young families who really wanted to give it a shot and were willing to work hard, and some singles and some college students who I think were young enough and naive enough and hopeful enough to just try something crazy and mm-hmm. go for it. And so we did. And in the early years, we moved around a lot. I'm trying to think about it. We met, I think, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 locations maybe in the first 5 years, years. I mean, we were moving around a lot.
And what type of locations were these? I'm interested in how house churches tend to start off. Were these houses, literally, or were
well,
you
we started
out
off in a
theaters?
House, and when we outgrew the house, we rented a church one Sunday night, and then they kicked us out, and then we rented another church Sunday night, and they kicked us out, and then we rented another church, and then we ended up getting a theater, and I mean, just we were pretty haphazard, poor, kind of itinerant bunch of ragtags. It was, you know, we had a website. We were one of the first churches that I know of to have a website. But just really held together by relationship. And what really helped us was an older congregation had died, and they had a small building that sat maybe 100, 150. And it was in a very obscure part of town, neighborhood, no parking, near the water, hard to get to. But they ended up giving us their facility. At least it gave us office space and a place to land and have bands practice and do some meetings and classes. And we started a Sunday morning service. And at that point, we were a church of maybe 150, 200. We were a couple of years old. And as soon as I started morning services, that one went from 40 to 800 people in less than a year.
Wow.
In a room that sat about 120, 150. I mean, so you're talking, we got to the point that men had to stand up outside with umbrellas and listen on a speaker. Only women could sit. Men would be in the basement, out the doors. I mean, there was only one legal parking spot. We jammed up this whole neighborhood, and it kind of exploded on us all of a sudden. At that time, we were also doing services in two other parts of the city, and I was driving around preaching all of them.
Mm-hmm.
This was before there were multi-site video venues and those kind of things. And so then we leveraged that to get into a bigger space, and it was an old warehouse that we converted. The first Sunday, we couldn't afford chairs, so everybody brought their own. So there's kitchen chairs and dining room chairs and camping chairs. I mean, it was not an impressive situation. But at that point, we were a church of about 1,000, 1,200, and it has grown every single year since. And, you know, and it's now 10,000, and right. We grew by, I think, about 1,500 in the last year, baptized almost 1,000 new Christians. It's been, since we got that morning service many years ago, it hasn't slowed down at all. It's just literally gone from 200 to 13,000.
Right. Amazing. It's a rapid overnight story. What's one of the interesting things that you just mentioned was the fact that once you got a regularized place to meet, it went from that 40 to 60 people up to 800 right away. And what's also interesting is as people start packing in. As you mentioned, it's a place, your first regular church building has about 150 capacity, but you get 800 people here. How are you getting these people to come in, especially if, you know, people see people, I guess, hanging outside the doors and holding up umbrellas listening to this? People standing outside in the rain in Seattle is not fun. So how do you attract people into doing this?
Yeah, we never advertised or promoted because we didn't have any money. So you can't afford to do any traditional marketing. So it was exclusively word of mouth. And so we reached one point, we're having seven services, I think, at our high water mark on Sundays. I'm preaching a lot, driving around, and it's just word of mouth. I mean, to be honest with you, even in telling the story, it just doesn't, if you, I mean, I would say God did something, and if you pull God out of the equation, it just, it's missing a variable. It doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Because there's a lot of churches that are broken, homeless, and meeting at night that don't go to 13,000,
right.
You know, with no advertising.
Yeah. Well, what about the content of the services? What were you doing at this time in terms
Bible
of that?
Bible teaching heavy. Sermons to this day are over an hour.
Mm-hmm.
So the sermon is longer than most church services. Singing, we have a lot of musicians, a lot of artists, a lot of creative types, and communion every week. So, I mean, it isn't that unusual. There's preaching, singing, communion, praying, but it's really centered around a pretty intense Bible message. I tend to go through books of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
So like I took a year and went through the book of Genesis. I'm taking 2.5 years right now and going through the book of Luke. I mean, so we're just going through books of the Bible.
Which is really interesting when you come to think about it, when a lot of scholars have notions about large, rapidly growing churches, they tend to think that they're not Bible-rooted, that they tend to be fluff, self-help types of organizations. But I spent some time online looking at a number of your sermons, specifically the Luke sermons that you're going through now, and we'll link to these online from our website so people can check them out. But they're heavily Bible-based.
Yeah.
I mean, this is Scripture coming right at you, and one would guess that that would be a big turnoff again for the Seattle, Washington crowd that is very libertarian, do it their own way type of sensibilities, but that's feeding some kind of hunger here. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think sociologically, a lot of people came from broken, divorced homes. A lot of people's family system is not intact. A lot of people were sexually abused, molested, raped. A lot of people have had substance abuse, experimentation, or addiction. And we provide a real strong countercultural way of life and teaching from the Bible. And whether they agree or disagree, they're curious by it because there's probably nowhere else you're going to hear it.
Right.
It's a very countercultural, counterintuitive view of God and life and how to live in this world. So, but a lot of them too, though, what they have had isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, probably upwards of half the people in my home, their parents split up. Maybe 30% of the gals, 20%+ of the guys were raped or molested. Many of them have been addicted, and their thing ain't working.
Right.
You know, when you're in your 20s and it's not working, you're looking at the next 50 years going, well, there's got to be an option. I got to have a plan B because this just isn't working for mm-hmm. me. And so where the family used to step in and set up, you know, certain systems, certain communities, certain values, certain maturing expectations, the church has kind of filled that role.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned that, and this is going back to what we talked a little bit earlier about, the demographic of your church tends to skew higher toward young single men than most any other churches. I mean, if you take a look around in any traditional denomination, the last person you see is somebody 22 years old and single in the church. But you have a lot of those folks there. So you probably had the opportunity to talk to them. What brings them through the door the first time? How do they get here to Mars Hill before anywhere else?
Yeah, usually it's some guy has a life-changing experience with Jesus, and then he grabs some buddies and brings them. And I tend to really, not at the neglect of the women, but really hammer on the guys. You know, grow up, be responsible, start making a plan for your future, stop looking at porn, stop sleeping with your girlfriend, stop using people, stop abusing people. You know, Jesus died for your sins, so you can actually stop sinning and start doing something else. And as the guys kind of get that vision, it's kind of the talk that their dad's supposed to give them.
Right.
But their dad was, you know, more irresponsible mm-hmm. than anyone. So I kind of come in, and we come in and kind of fill that dad slot and role. And then the guys respond to it really well. Nobody's ever challenged them. Nobody's ever rebuked them. Nobody's ever taught them. And so then they go get all their other buddies because they run in packs. They smoke weed together and play video games together and go to strip clubs together. So mm-hmm. they got a bunch of buddies that are just as confused as they are.
Yeah.
But where do you go? Like, you know, like right now you think about it, most major cities in America, you're a young guy who's, you know, working a part-time job, downloading porn, playing video games, and in a recreational softball league, and you decide, I'd like to grow up and be a man and maybe get married and have kids and pay my bills and do something constructive. Where do you go?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's jail if you don't figure it out.
Right.
But where do you go? And there, most cities, there's not a place for them to go. There's mm-hmm. There's nothing there to fix it. There's cops and rehabilitation centers and jails for the guys who don't fix it, but there's nowhere for them to go to get their life put together.
Let me ask a little bit about that, because one of the things that I noticed here in Seattle is that there are a number of traditional denominations, and I'm thinking, you know, specifically around the University of Washington. You just opened a branch campus there, and we'll talk a bit about. But some of them are very traditional denominations that will only draw in 35 and 40 individuals on a Sunday service.
Yeah.
What are you doing differently that you think that they're not doing? Why aren't those churches fulfilling the needs of the community that they're living in?
Yeah, and I think you know, I think churches sometimes are like kids. Some are going to be tall, some are going to be short, and that doesn't mean one's better than the other, as long as they're healthy. But some churches, it's theological. They really don't believe the Bible, and they're really not excited about Jesus as God. Some it's practical. They're just really disorganized, and they don't have a plan or a budget or a vision or know what to do with technology. Sometimes it's laziness. The work ethic of the leader isn't really that great. It's It's more like a passive chaplain. Well, if somebody shows up, I'll meet with them. But if they don't show up, you know, it's not my responsibility to go get anybody. Mm-hmm. And some of it as well, I think, is really not seeing ourselves as missionaries in the culture. Usually Christians think of missionaries as we put people in foreign countries, and we see ourselves as missionaries here. And so just like every missionary, you got to get to know the culture and love the people and find opportunities to serve and see where their lives are being damaged by untruth and see what is the best way to love, serve, welcome, teach them. And so we've always kind of had that posture of what would it look like if a missionary was dropped in Seattle?
Right. It's a place where there's a lot of unbelief, and so that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, because if we're going to drop people in a pagan country, the odds are the number of people that are Bible-believing Christians in Seattle is probably real similar.
Yeah. So as you start growing here, and you're talking about some of the older denominations not being able to leverage the technology and such, one of the interesting things that I find about Mars Hill is that you have branch campuses around Seattle, and now one in New Mexico as well. Recently opened one at just a few blocks off the University of Washington campus. And you're using technology to connect these things. That sermons are actually broadcast through
It's a video medium. Yeah. Well,
how did this all come about? Where did you get the idea for this? I mean, a certain point in time, you're sitting in this church with room for 150, and then you have 800 people, and you say, "Well, we got to find someplace bigger," and you continue growing. So, what brought about the idea of the multi-site?
Yeah, we were doing multi-site years ago, and I was driving between the three locations, three small rooms, and then they all grew at the same time. And unlike God, I can't be in more than one place at one time. So then we got a bigger room, thinking, well, we'll just put it all together and get more seats. And then before long, that big room that sat 1,300 had five services on Sunday. Well, at that point, I can't really preach much more than that, and we can't have many more services than that. It's just kind of done. And the city of Seattle at the time had what I would consider, and what some attorneys we've consulted would consider, a discriminatory policy to where you could build organizations and theaters and venues, but not churches. And so there was a particular zoning restriction against churches, and it wasn't just in Seattle. A lot of cities had this same thing. And so for us, it was, well, we either don't grow, and we started at certain points, turning away a few hundred people a service, literally just shutting the doors and having people stay outside and say, sorry, you can't come to church today.
And that's got to be really hard.
That's
not a message you want to
send. That's not what you want to send. You're like, well, and at the time, too, I'm still in my, you know, early to mid-30s. It's like, well, I'm not done yet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, we still, there's still time on the clock here.
Right.
And we didn't want to turn people away. That's just very rude. People, you know, even if they're non-Christians, they drive in, they park. There's no parking, so they walk for blocks to be told, you can't come to church today. So it was, we either fight the city and get real litigious and get an attorney and fight the zoning restrictions, and we didn't want to be in an adversarial relationship with the city because we love the city, or we do like a lot of churches that had grown in the city did or do, and that's leave the city and go to the suburbs, mm-hmm. where find a place that has better zoning and relocate there. But we really want to be in the city, and we love the city. We want to go after young people, and not that there's anything wrong with the suburbs, but around the suburbs of Seattle, there's a whole bunch of bigger churches, but there wasn't something in the city for the city. So then it was, well, could we use technology? We've already got the room is big enough that there's screens in the back so that they could, you know, even see the preaching, because once you get over a certain number of feet, it's hard to see. And people are downloading everything on the internet, so is it possible to use the technology? And a few churches have just started doing that. There's actually about 2,000 churches in America right now that are doing multi-site.
Right.
A percentage of those are video. So we tried it as an experiment up in Shoreline, which was a suburban community, started asking, could we start campuses in the suburban areas so that the people who live around the city will stay there and love and serve the people in their community and leave seats open in the city for us to continue to reach people who live in the city. And so we did it as a cheap experiment, and it went really well. And so that was a few years ago. Like you said, we just opened our 9th campus. In the last year, we had, I think it was 1,340 Sunday services.
Wow.
I mean, just...
Yeah.
It's pretty staggering.
Yeah.
1,340 Sunday services. So each location has its own campus pastor, who's the first among equals leader, an elder team, a pastoral team, leadership team, staff team, children's ministry, small groups, mercy ministry, justice, serving in the community. Everything's the music. Everything's there except for me. And I preach about 75% of the time, and then live preachers preach at every campus about 25% of the time. So there's a preaching team with me as well. And it's totally worked. Our fastest growing and most committed and generous campuses are those with video.
Which is a absolutely fascinating way to actually do this. And in many ways, I think it's a, as I was thinking about your church, as I was looking through the website and how it's actually arranged, it's a blend of televangelism, which oftentimes gets a very bad name, but also of being there. And I think for a lot of people, being somewhere in a community physically with people on a Sunday morning is really important. I mean, you can't reach God without other people around, I think, in many ways.
Yeah, I mean, we see Christianity as God's a father, and we're a family, and you want to get together and hang out with the family. And for us, too, that includes small groups and homes. We call them community groups. So, you know, people get together on Sunday, but really life is done together every week, a meal, time together, friendship, helping each other move, pay the bills, serving their community, helping out at whatever local mercy ministry or point of need that has surfaced. And I think we're at about 500 of those groups.
Wow. Yeah.
With about, I mean, I'm trying to do the numbers in my head, maybe 7,000-8,000 people in groups. And so people come together for the big events, but really life is lived together in homes and condos and dorms and apartments and relationships.
Yeah, we talked with Mark Vanderer in an earlier podcast, which we'll link to, about how large churches have been leveraging the small group environment that, again, among many scholars who look at these large churches, they see it as very superficial. But there's these aspects of it that go deeper, such as the small groups. You meet on Sunday in large groups, but on a Wednesday night, you get together and you do a number of different things. I know one of my churches that I used to go to had a small group for horseback riding that people did and share the gospel before they went on a trail ride. So it's really interesting how that works. Now, how in terms of these different branch campuses, roughly are they roughly the same size or some bigger than the others?
No, they really vary pretty wildly. I mean, our smallest campus is maybe 400. Our largest campus is about 4,000.
Okay.
And so the sizes are all along the continuum. So, yeah, I mean, there's a variety. There's a family, it's like kids. There's a family resemblance, but the kids are all different. So, like, our latest one, we just started a few weeks ago, that you mentioned, next to the University of Washington. They're at 800, 2 weeks in.
That which was amazing. Now, I actually want to talk a little bit about that, given that that's my home institution. Attracting college students on the University of Washington campus and getting 800, and I assume that most of these are UW students.
Yeah, out the door, literally standing on the sidewalk, we're having to add more services. We're back to the same situation. We physically cannot get them all in the building.
Wow. And so how does one attract college students? What's the message that brings them through the door? It's amazing.
Same thing. A lot of it is that there was a group of students meeting in community groups across the campus that coalesced together as a team that wanted to do this. And so for us, I mean, I guess maybe that's one of the big differentiations is in a traditional church, you pay the pastor to do the ministry. And our view is the leader's job is to train the people to do the ministry. So, you know, if you have 200 college kids who feel like this is my church and I want to reach my friends and I have something big that I can do, that's 200 people that are fired up and ready to do something. And next thing you know, you got 800.
Right.
As opposed to 40 people who pay one person to take care of them. It's a really different mentality.
You know, I can see how that is. And I can see how that also comes from your experience, you know, your background coming out of college and then working through a Bible study group and just really, you know, pushing through hard and doing the grunt work just out of, you know, pure enthusiasm and the pure Holy Spirit working through you in order to achieve these kind of things, and duplicating that amongst others, I think, is a very powerful pastoral model.
Yeah, and then the people love it. It's their church,
right?
You know, and it's their mission, and it's their Jesus, and it's their friends, and man, the more people, for me, it's like we exist to help people do what God lays on their heart. Mm-hmm. And if they're already passionate about something and we can help them do it well, man, a self-motivated band of volunteers, thousands of them, you can never hire a staff that does what they do.
And just to give a sense for our listeners of how amazing this is, you're talking 800 students on the weekend coming to the Mars Hill Branch campus off the University of Washington. We have roughly about 35,000 undergraduates there. And so that's a lot of undergraduates, but 800 college students coming to church in only just a few months is a few weeks. You've only been in operation about 2 months, so yeah, 8 weeks or so, which is absolutely amazing. Any plans for Washington State, which is your home institution?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, when I became a Christian there, I got into a really great church that was a cool combination of college students, professors, and farmers. I mean, so it was this really eclectic community. It was wonderful. So Washington State University, if you can believe it, has around it more sort of evangelical, Bible-based churches than the University of Washington does. My friend Judith Smith from the City Church, they've got a campus there next to the University of Washington as well. University Presbyterian Church has been very active there for a very long time. But after that, it gets pretty small pretty fast, and mm-hmm. it drops off pretty quickly as far as college student participation. So I know the UW had a great need. My pastor running the University of Washington campus, he's got big ambitions to start similar expressions of Mars Hill mm-hmm. on all kinds of college campuses. So we'll see if he can pull it together. Yeah, we'll see what his plan is.
And what about the New Mexico church? How did that come about? Because one would think you know, if you take a look at the map of where Mars Hill branch locations are, you can see them moving from the neighborhood of Ballard here in Seattle outwards. But moving to New Mexico, that's a pretty big jump. How'd that one come about?
Yeah, it was a big jump. We're going to do Southern California and Portland next. Mm-hmm. So we had a good leader there. We have a network of church planners. We're a non-denominational, interdenominational church. So we work across 20 different denominations and networks mm-hmm. with our church planning network. So we've seen started through the network about 350 churches in the U.S. Mm-hmm. and then a number overseas as well. And so we had one of these church planners in Albuquerque, New Mexico, who was a really good leader and someone we really just real kindred with and loved. And started talking with that pastor, what would it be like if perhaps we worked together? So Albuquerque's a arty, creative city. The church was in the city, near the university. So as far as our sweet spot and where we've had success historically, it fit more that way. So he shut down the church plant and became a campus.
Okay.
And so I think as a church was probably running 250, 300, and about a year ago it became a campus of Mars Hill, and we transitioned it into a full Mars Hill campus. I was just down there this last weekend to see how things were going and preach on Sunday, and I think we had about 900.
Mm-hmm.
And so on an average Sunday they're running about 600 plus.
Mm-hmm.
But that's pretty, I mean, that's more than double the attendance in about a year.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the experiment for us was, is this going to work out of state, far away from Seattle?
Right.
And it does.
Yeah.
Or at least it did yeah. once. We'll see if it does again.
Now, what's the difference between a church plant, and I want to talk about your Acts 29 network here in a minute, a church plant and becoming a Mars Hill campus? What's the difference there?
Yeah, a church plant's an independent organization. Legally, it's its own organization. It has its own preacher, its own leaders. The church has its own name, and we give 10% of everything we bring in to help plant churches.
Mm-hmm.
If you're going to be a Mars Hill campus, well, then you get the Mars Hill name, but then we also help set policies and procedures and how things are done. You're part of our legal organization. You're an employee of our legal entity, and I'm going to be doing the preaching 75% of the time.
Right.
And so, yeah, it's that variation.
Mm-hmm.
But we do both, and we support both. And between Acts 29 and Mars Hill, I think we're at about, just in the U.S., about 100,000 people a Sunday.
Wow.
Which is crazy, because it was 14 years ago this month, you know, we started, and on Sunday nights we had 50 or 60.
Yeah, that's just astounding growth.
Yeah, it's crazy.
The Acts 29 Network, how did this come about, and how do you go about locating areas to plant churches?
Yeah, we started early on as a church plant, and not being in a denomination, I learned a lot of things the hard way, made a lot of mistakes, and wanted to build an association, a network, where young church planters in particular could come together and just love one another, serve one another, share with one another, and also help to raise funds to get them started. And so we did a few over the years, just informally, and then it formalized as a legal organization. And then we hired some full-time staff out of Mars Hill. As Mars Hill grew, we were able to start to put more into it. I originally started Acts 29 with a Presbyterian pastor in Florida. Mm-hmm. And we couldn't have been more far apart. He is now retired. And as Mars Hill started growing, we were able to put more money into it and help to bring on more staff. And it has been extraordinary. So we do things called boot camps where we have training and assessment of potential church planters. We've developed a full assessment process. Mm-hmm. That's pretty thorough. Our success rate is about 98%.
How do you define success rate? That
if we approve them to mm-hmm. go plant a church, 98% of them do so successfully.
Okay. And they have the longevity and...
Yeah, and usually the church planting failure rate's over 50%. It's like starting a new business.
Yeah, like a restaurant or something.
Yeah,
right?
So it'd be like the business school at the University of Washington saying 98% of our MBAs who launch a business succeed. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty crazy statistical possibility. Nothing new tends to work at that rate. So we have that assessment process.
What are some of the aspects of the assessment? How do you know that this church that you're going to plant is going to make it? What are you looking for? And what happens in the boot camp that gets mm-hmm. the success rate up to an astounding 98%?
Yeah, you're looking at theological, what do they believe about Jesus and the Bible and Christian essentials. Part of it is you're checking references, character and history and work ethic. Part of it is we've got a lot of psychological analysis as well. So we'll do personality types and entrepreneurial scores. Entrepreneurial scores, super helpful. Also, we will sit down with them and their wife for half a day. And there's a pretty massive inventory of questions as to marital health and fidelity and love. And our feeling is that sometimes the big issue in a church is the pastor and his wife don't have a great marriage.
Hmm.
And so, if they don't get along well, if they're not loving one another, if their sex life isn't satisfactory, if they don't know how to resolve conflict, it's going to spill out into their kids, it's going to spill out into the church. And the most important relationship, humanly speaking, is between the pastor and his wife.
Right.
And if that relationship is not good, it's going to go bad. Yeah. So a big part of the assessment is getting to know the wife and family system, talking to the kids, really investigating that family. So it takes a while to go through the assessment process. It culminates with a boot camp and a sit-down interview. There's continually, in the assessment process, 500 candidates. Some disqualified, some qualified with conditions. And so all over the U.S. and world, we're continually assessing hundreds of leaders.
Mm-hmm. And we're in, now in terms of the locations, you're basically
everywhere.
Picking locations where, people say, hey, I want in on this Acts 29 network. I'm excited about what you're doing. And I live in Racine, Wisconsin. So sign me up. Is that how it works out?
Yeah, and it's where the leaders pick. It's kind of like the same thing we do in the church where, what are you excited about?
Mm-hmm.
What do you feel like God wants you to do? We're going to assess and see if we agree with that. And if we do, and you're qualified, we're going to help you do it.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't come to a leader and say, here's what we need you to do. We come to the leader and just say, what do you feel like God wants you to do? And they'll say, I love this city, and my heart is for this city, and I really want to serve these people. Great. Then let's assess you. And if you qualify, we're going to coach you, formal coaching system. We have a funding mechanism. We have a training and support mechanism for you and your family. We want to help you do that.
Mm-hmm. It's fascinating when you talk about how you're identifying people who want to work with this. You use the word entrepreneurial spirit, but I mean, you're also focusing on relationships, and this is very different than what a number of traditional mainline denominations, how they go about picking their pastors. It's usually people who sign up to go to seminary school. They go to college, they finish their degree, and then the question is, okay, where do we ship you out to, you know, to start your ministry in that regard? So absolutely fascinating difference in the model and how this actually works. Have you gotten any criticism for this type of model? I mean, one could see that, well, this is a very business-oriented thing, and religion's not about the entrepreneurial spirit and such, but you know, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, about half of our pastors, or maybe a little more, have formal theological education.
Okay.
So some do, some don't. It's not a criteria for us. I mean, I would say on the flip side, too, there's a lot of churches that are dying that have a pastor who's got a degree in it.
Right.
That alone, a degree's not bad. I've gotten a master's degree in theology, and we've actually started a school, and we've got 100 and some students in it right now. So we're not opposed to that. But, yeah, to me, church isn't a business, but it should conduct itself in such a way that it's a good steward. Just like a family's not a business, but a family has assets and a house and kids to look after and bills to pay and resources to steward. So you never look at a family and say, oh, you guys shouldn't have a checkbook and you shouldn't, you know, paint the walls in the house and you shouldn't cut the grass because you guys aren't a business. Like, no, we're a family and we need to tend to the house and tend to the budget. And a lot of churches, quite frankly, just they don't do that really well. I mean, the building's falling apart and things aren't really well tended to, and the money maybe isn't allocated as effectively as it could be. So, I mean, anytime you do anything, you're definitely going to get critics. But because we work across 20-some denominations and networks, I think they know, you know, we love you and we're here to help. We're not just trying to criticize, but if we can find some good leaders and we built some good systems, we can give them to you for free because we don't take any money from them. We do all of this for free. Mars Hill gives, this year we'll give $1.5 million to church planting to help underwrite a lot of this. So when you show up and say, we'll give you a lot of things for free and help you find leaders, They're pretty excited because that's a good deal for them.
Yeah. Now, you said you work across 20 different denominations. What are these denominations that you've worked with?
Yeah, boy, I have to get the list. I know we've got Evangelical Free and a couple. I mean, there's a couple different kinds of Baptists: Southern Baptist, Conservative Baptist. We got guys in the Evangelical Covenant. There's some folks that are in the Assemblies of God. There's some folks who are Presbyterian Church in America. Then there's other networks like Sovereign Grace with C.J. Mahaney or. Yeah, just so it's this list of kind of groups, and so people can be in our network and in a denomination. They can do both.
Mm. Has that created any tension with denominations? Are some denominations a little bit nervous about this, and has there been a little bit of pushback from some?
Yeah, some. I mean, not necessarily from the top, but sometimes those in the denomination who are a little more controlling and protective, they see this influence as maybe a little more aggressive than they would like. But our hope is to just serve well and produce good results and over time just earn credibility.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's happening. I hope that's happening.
Now, in addition to the Acts 29 network, you also have something known as the Resurgence. And
yeah.
What is that?
Yeah, that really comes out of God's call in my life initially. We said to Mary Grace, so I married Grace and I love her, and we got five kids. Preach the Bible, that's Mars Hill Church. Plant churches, that's Acts 29. And then train men, train leaders, and that gets done in large part through the Resurgence. So I've kind of built my life to do those four things as best I can.
Mm-hmm.
The Resurgence exists to train pastors and leaders and equip and resource them, anybody who wants it. So it's one of the top Christian blogs on the internet, podcasts, vodcasts. We host conferences. We publish a line of books called Relit with a variety of authors. Resound, we release music. Retrain, so we've got a master's level program for theological training that a few seminaries have now actually adopted and they're accrediting for us. So yeah, it's classes, conferences, books, blogs, and a lot of it, too, is just networking, connecting people who are doing like-minded things.
Right. Now, I went through there, and the blog is absolutely fascinating. You have a number of people posting different things, and there's videos on there, and it's just a really neat way of leveraging a lot of different interests that people might have. And as you say, it's resurgence or re-energizing in many ways for individuals about that. And what about Mars Hill Global? You mentioned you started here in Seattle, you expanded to the outer rings, you get down to New Mexico, the Acts 29 is taking you all throughout the country. Where is it going globally?
Yeah, we have had some really kind of exploratory conversations about where next. I pulled down all the Google Analytics of who downloads us and who follows us internationally, and some of our biggest cities are London and Sydney.
Really?
Melbourne.
Yeah.
I think I've preached at this point in 11 countries. Mm-hmm. I think I've preached on almost every continent.
Physically in 11 countries.
Physically.
You've probably been downloaded by 150 or more.
Yeah.
I would guess.
Yeah. And so started looking at, as I'm traveling and there's podcasters that come out, I mean, some of the events now are 10,000 people in mm-hmm. cities I've never been to. And stand in line and meet hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, and they're all podcasters. They're all listening online.
Right.
So it's like, okay, well, what do we do with this? It's this whole global phenomenon. We're now, with the internet, the world's not that big, and people aren't that far away. So the big logistical hurdle that we've been having is we investigate countries like England or Australia. Those are probably the two, you know, lowest hanging fruit to pick. Are the legal issues. How do you have a multinational church, and how do you own real estate,
right,
and how do you do hiring and benefits? And it's so we're hiring a full-time attorney. We're seeking to hire a full-time attorney on staff just because part of it is it has gotten so complicated. I mean, it's hard enough to go from one state to another,
right,
to go from one country to another. We're open to doing it, but how to do that in a way that is within the confines of their laws and also meet the confines of our laws. That's a tough nut to crack.
Yeah, this happens to be one of my very specific research interests of how governments regulate religions and the variations in that. And what struck me just a few minutes ago here when you said that London is one of the places you've seen the most hits, you think about the general claims that Europe is incredibly secular and people are losing their faith and they're believing. But here in London, when these podcasts can go across, you know, the ocean and easily be picked up by anybody sitting in their living room, you all of a sudden find out that they're not as secular as you might think, that there's a big thirst for God's word out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's just a matter of getting in there. And as you say, this internet technology is a very interesting way of getting there. And, you know, I've made the claim, a number of things I've written is that the different laws that restrict churches from doing creative things in Europe is really one of the things that's holding back a resurgence, so to speak, in that area.
Yeah, and I agree with that. And, you know, we're seeing the percentage of evangelicals, as I understand it, is going up in London.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a, you know, there is a younger emerging generation. We'll see how it plays out and what happens. But there is an interest in Jesus and the Bible. And I do think anytime you have a change in technological delivery system, historically you've gotten Reformation and Revival. That definitely happened with the printing press.
Mm-hmm.
You know, radio and television and brought certain opportunities. You know, speakers, amplification provides an opportunity for men like Billy Graham, whereas previously you couldn't get 80,000 people together to hear a sermon.
Right.
You know, and now with the internet, it's this new technological delivery method that usually when that happens, a whole young generation kind of gets an opportunity to try something new.
Mm-hmm. Now, let me ask you, one of the terms that you have been affiliated with is something known as the emerging church, or mm-hmm. sometimes also called the emergent church.
Yeah.
Could you give us an idea of what that is about and what your thoughts are on those tags?
Yeah, in the I'm trying to think here. It would have been in the mid-1990s, I got invited to my first pastor's conference. To be honest with you, I didn't even know there was such a thing as a pastor's conference. I was just starting a church and went to it, and it was a lot of young leaders was kind of the auspices of the event, young leaders getting together for networking and training. And we were not a big church at the time, 100, 200, I don't know, but they allowed me to speak at it. And so I spoke about what we were doing and some of the things we were learning. And that kind of formed into a team under an organization called Leadership Network of young leaders that traveled and spoke and did some consulting and such. And to be honest with you, I shouldn't have been doing that. My attitude was pretty foul, and I didn't have a church that was ready to be emulated. I mean,
mm-hmm.
I hadn't done much, and I didn't have any right to be telling anybody what to do. I still had a lot to learn. I still have a lot to learn. But that kind of morphed to where then some other leaders joined the team, and they went to launch something called the Emergent Village, something also called the Emerging Church. And it was at that point that I resigned the team and left.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe 97, 98, 99, somewhere in there. It was in the mid to late 90s. I didn't agree with where some of the leaders wanted to go theologically.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to be, I use the language, I tend to be culturally liberal and theologically conservative,
mm-hmm.
meaning, I preach in jeans and, you know, half our worship team is having cigarettes before the service. But I also am really hardcore Bible guy who loves the Bible and loves Jesus. And so, you know, when they started talking about, you know, maybe there is no hell, maybe not everybody's as sinful as we think, maybe you can go to heaven without Jesus, maybe he didn't rise from death, I was out. I'm mm-hmm. like, I'm a Bible-believing, conservative Christian. And I have, you know, certain strong convictions that I'm unwilling to even reconsider. Not because I haven't considered them, but I have considered them. I've come to a conclusion.
Mm-hmm.
I've also come to a conclusion that Grace is my wife, so I'm not wanting to entertain other options. Mm-hmm. I'm settled, you know.
Right.
There's certain relationships that I'm just committed to, Jesus and Grace being first among them. And so I left that team at the time, and they have gone in a far more liberal theological direction. I've spoken out against that, written out against that, and kind of my leaving that team, I think, kind of split young leaders at that time. Not that I was the only leader, but me leaving it caused some others to leave as well.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you mentioned that you've learned a lot over the last decade and a half in the church building process and bringing people in. If you could think about some of the major things that you've learned that might be helpful for other people thinking about building churches or church planting or even attending churches, what things have you learned over the past decade and a half that really stand out in your mind?
No, I appreciate the question. My job is really to deal with sin and people who are sinned against. And so when people sin, they need to know what to do with that, because
mm-hmm.
They make a wreck of their life and other people's lives. And so for us, it's, hey, Jesus is God, and he died and rose, and there's a way to have that sin forgiven and to get a new life and to do it different. And I think most Bible-believing churches, you know, they'll tell you that. That's not new information. It's incredibly important, but it's not new. I think where we struggled for years, and some churches perhaps still do struggle, is what happens not when you've sinned, but you're the one who sinned against, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You're not the rapist, you're the rape victim.
Mm-hmm.
You're not the abusive boyfriend, you're the battered woman. What do you do not when you're the father who walked out on his family, but you're the kid who got bailed on by their dad? What do you do? And so a lot of our focus has been for those who've been wounded and hurt. What does it mean for them to be able to forgive? What does it mean for them to overcome bitterness? What does it mean for them to to really bring those griefs and those pains to God and to get healed up and to then move on with a life that he intends for them. Not being in any way simplistic or trite about it, it's painful. I mean,
mm-hmm.
if you just took all the, all the sexual abuse victims in my church, just those who were raped, molested, assaulted, and abused sexually, I'd still have a mega church,
mm-hmm.
which is 2,000 or more people.
Right.
You know, I mean, so it's just, people are just walking wounded.
Mm-hmm.
And so for us, it's if you say we're here to help hurting people, you get a lot of them.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a big magical formula. It's like putting out a sign that says we help hurting people. Well, all of a sudden they show up.
Yeah.
You know?
So what is the future of Mars Hill Church? You're still young, very energetic. Actually, I have to admit, one of the big, and I just recently went through this in my life when we changed churches, that for the first time I had a pastor who was younger than me.
Yeah.
Which is a very interesting mental adjustment. So,
yeah.
But You're still young, energetic. What's the future of Mars Hill? Where do you see you going in the next couple decades?
Yeah, I turned 40 yesterday.
Oh, well, happy birthday.
So, thank you.
welcome to the 40s.
Yeah. And so, Gracie and I, my wife and our five kids, we've talked and prayed about it a lot, and we see ourselves staying in Seattle. You know, if I could have my life be one God, one woman, one church, I'd be very happy with that. That would be awesome. And so that's what I'm praying and planning and preparing for. So we want to be in Seattle, you know, until I'm done, till we're done. So we're going to be here. I'm going to be doing what I'm doing. I don't have any desire to go anywhere else. I mean, I get job offers and opportunities, and to be honest with you, I'm just really content mm-hmm. with what I'm doing. I love what I'm doing. I love the people I'm working with. I love how God has been so gracious to us and so much has gotten done. Still feel like there's a lot left to do. We're going to continue to plant churches. The goal is to be at 1,000 church plants in less than 5 years, with a total of 250,000 people in those churches.
Wow. Yeah.
So, and that's, you know, and then after that, we'll see what comes next. With Mars Hill, we're going to start a couple campuses by God's grace in the next few years, and among those will be additional out of states like Portland and Southern California and a couple more in the Seattle area. And I could see right now getting Mars Hill to 15,000 to 20,000 a week. It's not going to happen immediately, but I can see getting there if everything comes together. So I plan on just keep basically doing what I'm doing, writing, preaching, teaching, loving my wife, playing with my five kids, and planting churches. So I mean, I feel like I was really blessed to kind of get my slot young
right. And
get a good long run at it.
Yeah.
And I just want to be faithful and keep going in that direction, and by God's grace, you know, finish well when I'm 70 or 80, and, you know, and still love my wife and still be doing what I'm doing.
Well, it's an amazing story, and we thank you for sharing it here on Research on Religion. And we wish you all the blessings in the world when it comes to the future of your church.
Cool.
Thank you very much.
You bet, man.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.